welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. Today, the question of the week, following a historic upset in the race for President of the United States. The political polling showed a likely win for Hillary Clinton. The betting markets were going that way. Her campaign ordered all the decorations for a victory party. But then, despite winning more actual votes across the country, Clinton lost in the Electoral College to Donald Trump. How did the polls get it so wrong? What forces were moving in the country to propel Trump to this victory? And what happened in the Indiana races? Today, two distinguished Hoosier political scientists. We'll talk with Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU-Purdue Fort Wayne. But first, Professor Joseph Losko, chair of the Department of Political Science at Ball State University and co-director of the Bowen Center for Public Affairs.
Well, I think expectations were built up that Clinton would win. And there was good reason for it in the early polling, but as the polling got later and later into the season, as some events occurred, like the FBI director with possible additional investigations, that started people recalibrating. And the late polling did catch some of that, but of course polling is only a snapshot at the time. And so the real polling occurs on Election Day, and it's hard to poll right up until Election Day. Another problem was that the electorate was changing as well. Some people who were turned off by the rhetoric of the campaign decided to stay home, but there was a new group that was enthused and motivated by Trump and his rhetoric, and they came out. They were not factored into the electorate that is weighted in most polls, and as a result, they were missed. And it wasn't a huge amount. We're talking about maybe about 2%. But that's about the margin of error that the pollsters early on were giving. So that was just enough of a boost in these people who had previously not voted and who were energized by Trump to move them into the electorate at the last minute.
There was a suggestion that the polls were rigged and the process was rigged and everything. And I think that the idea of different groups being weighted was brought up at that time. Part of it is that the general public, we don't always understand how this works.
Sure. And if, you know, there is precedent for this as well. If you go back to 1980, up until about a week before the election, Jimmy Carter was favored to win by a pretty good margin. It wasn't until the weekend before the election that public opinion really changed and moved in a very dramatic direction and brought Reagan to victory.
You almost wonder if there isn't a sociological component to this. Society is changing, right?
Absolutely, and a lot of people feel left out of the new economy. You know, there are areas like Muncie here where, you know, it's still a bastion of the old industry. That old industry is gone, perhaps forever. It's very hard to retool people who had very good livings back then, very good livelihood. And as a result, they've not seen any gains in their personal fortune or income. They've seen, in fact, a kind of depression of their environment. They're in an almost economic depression, whereas those in the new economy are doing just fine. So those people have felt left out and without a voice. Neither political party, prior to Donald Trump, was really speaking to those individuals directly. And with his rhetoric and bombast and his approach, he energized them and empowered them in ways that they had not felt for a long time.
Is this really populism, or is that just the handle of the moment to describe what's happened?
Well, I think it is populism. The undercurrent of individuals who feel left out have risen up with Trump's voice. Now, where that will go is anybody's guess. With any kind of populism, as the populism of the early 20th century, there are some downsides of that as well that we have to be aware of. Some of the rhetoric about race and misogyny, those are parts of populist movements as well, and we have to guard against that.
I'm recalling after 2012, Wasn't there a postmortem on the part of the GOP that said, look, we have to recognize that the nature of the country is changing? What happened to that?
Yeah, that postmortem specified a variety of things. One, reach out to Latinos to get more of them involved in Republican politics. Second, a decrease in the number of candidates who compete with each other in the primary. Limitation of the primary season, a limitation of debates, more inclusive language. All of those things were completely ignored, and Donald Trump just drove his truck right through it.
To the extent that we can, I guess, trust polls, my whole world's turned upside down. Can we trust the exit polls? But he got more of the Latino vote than might have been expected.
He got 2% more than Mitt Romney did 4 years ago, and that's a real surprise given the kind of rhetoric he's been espousing about Mexicans and Hispanics in general. I think, again, that we probably misread the Latino vote, the Hispanic vote. It's probably a bit more diverse than we had anticipated, plus Hillary Clinton may have alienated them in some ways as well.
The Democratic turnout in Detroit and Milwaukee wasn't big enough to overcome what was happening in the more rural areas.
Absolutely. The number of African Americans, the numbers of young people just did not turn out as expected. They were not motivated. They were not enthused. The Trump people were. Millennials especially were a very important factor, urban millennials, an important factor in Obama's win in both 2008 and 2012. They not only didn't show up in sufficient numbers, but many of them crossed over. White millennials, 18 to 29, actually voted for Trump, which was a surprise to just about everyone. And of course, there were third-party candidates this time that siphoned off some of that vote as well. There were just enough fewer voters among millennials in the key battleground states to throw those states to Trump.
Professor Joseph Losko, co-director of the Bowen Center for Public Affairs and chair of the Political Science Department. Coming up, The View from Andy Downs.
Indiana Weekend. Interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Talking today about the election results with two people who can help us understand what happened at the national level and here in Indiana. You heard from Ball State's Joseph Losko. We'll have him back again. But first, Professor Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU-Purdue Fort Wayne. He joined us by Skype.
I think what's important is people go back and take a look at the polling data that was used to forecast what was going to happen in the election. If you look at states like Florida and Ohio and Michigan and to a lesser degree, North Carolina, Nevada, Pennsylvania, you'll actually find that in a lot of those states, the margin of victory was pretty thin if you look at sort of the aggregate of the polls. And that whenever you have a narrow band like that, what you're really looking at is the possibility of a narrow victory or a narrow defeat. Now, part of the reason that people believed that Clinton was going to win was because there were so many options for her. Win this state, win that state, you have a victory. Win this state and that state, you have a victory. And Donald Trump pretty much had one path to get there. And for him last night, it was a heck of a night because that one path managed to work its way out. So first of all, you look at the polling data and you see that the victory was actually possible, although not probable, it was possible. Secondly, if you look at the actual turnout that we had, you'll notice that for Republicans, turnout was pretty good. And we see that not only in terms of raw numbers, but in terms of, for example, the exit polling shows that Donald Trump managed to secure 90% of the vote of Republicans. That's about what you would expect for a strong Republican nominee to get. A lot of people didn't think that was possible. They thought that would be down closer to like 85, maybe 83%. And then you go deeper into the data and you see things like the fact that rural voters showed up in stronger numbers than anticipated. And the Hispanic vote, which a lot of people thought would really break heavily toward Hillary Clinton, it just didn't. And so while political scientists, we may not be great at predicting things, afterwards, when we start looking at the data, it becomes a little bit easier to see how we got to the margin and the winner we got to.
Surprises on election night included Michigan, which hadn't supported a Republican for president since 1988.
Yeah, in the case of Michigan, we should remember that, first of all, back in the primary, a lot of the polls got that wrong. They thought that Clinton was going to do quite well there, and there were reasons to think that in terms of some of the demographics. But Michigan and Pennsylvania, both states that are considered to be part of the Rust Belt, that's where you found a good number of the less well-educated white male voters who actually were angry about stuff. They wanted to know where their next job was going to come from. And that's not a message that she necessarily delivered to them, not only in the primary, but also in the general election. In fact, when it came to Michigan, Donald Trump, in many respects, just had to keep saying NAFTA, NAFTA, NAFTA. And that resonated really well with the folks who saw their jobs go away with that trade agreement.
Some of the efforts to understand the outcome have focused on Democratic turnout. Did they fail to get key parts of their base out to the polls?
I think you have to look at both sides of the balance sheet here. The Republicans had pretty good turnout and Democrats did not.
Yeah.
And part of that was about motivation. Hillary Clinton did not motivate the way that Barack Obama did. Even though she was going to be a first, she just doesn't have the speaking style, the way to attract and rile people up the way Barack Obama can. She doesn't have the ability to connect with people the way Bill Clinton did. And so you had somebody who could easily be characterized as old guard and somebody who had basically 1,000 cuts. And this ended up to some degree being death by 1,000 cuts. It's hard to be inspired when you yourself think, well, she's not perfect, but that when candidates are describing someone that way, that's not a recipe for success. And by the way, if we take a look at this at the state level, Indiana also had somewhat low turnout. Up in the northwest part of the state, the Democrats hope to pick up as many as maybe 4 seats in the Indiana House to help get them out of the super minority. They picked up one. One of them might go to a recount, but I think it's probably outside the probability that a recount would actually change the outcome of the election. So even in a Democratic stronghold, you see Democrats not performing particularly well. So that's evidence that they just weren't that inspired.
Democrats were unable to reelect Evan Bayh, someone who had a history in the state as the son of Birch Bayh and as a governor and senator.
And you think, okay, this is it. This is going to be the thing that helped to throw everything over the top in Indiana. But the reality is, campaigning is something you have to do on a regular basis to stay in practice. So he was a little rusty. And also, there were issues that just kept dogging him, whether it was where he lived or what he did after he left the Senate or what he was doing before he left the Senate. Those issues just kept dogging him throughout the rest of the campaign in that shortened sense, unlike with Dan Coats, who 6 years earlier had many of the same criticisms lobbed at him. But he went through a primary and dealt with them, and he sat down with the media and had long conversations with them about what he did, and that sort of made the issue go away. Evan Bayh didn't do that, and then on top of all of these problems, Evan Bayh's not really been one to go out and do a lot of knocking on doors and grassroots-type campaigning that was really necessary to energize people this year. So, you know, you start putting all that together, and you do see that Democrats, in many respects, just didn't have that thing that was going to motivate really high turnout.
Downs says the bigger surprise was in the Indiana governor race.
John Gregg was ahead in a couple of those polls, but even those kind of narrowed down a little bit. And when polling is done, if your sample is not a good representative sample, you're setting yourself up for a problem. And we know nationwide the sampling did miss out on rural voters, and it missed out on white males who had high school diploma or less. And the same thing probably happened here. That's not a part of the electorate that you think is really going to show up strong. And there was this belief that the gender gap, which was pretty large, was going to be even larger. And so in some respects, women were oversampled or overweighted in the sample. And you can start to understand methodologically how that would happen.
That's Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU Purdue Fort Wayne. He joined us by Skype for our advanced reporting class, and I thought you might want to hear his thoughts too.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
What are we missing here? What are we not seeing? There's been a suggestion that the real break is in education, that well-educated people simply aren't seeing the hardships faced by much of America.
I think that's right. Those without education, without higher education, are not well-equipped for the new economy. It is the new economy that we're living in. It's a global age we're living in. These are people who are not easily retrained. You know, I've had people in my class, middle-aged individuals in my classes coming back to retool, and it's very difficult for them to do that and to compete with 18-year-olds. There have got to be other ways in which their lives can be turned around, other kinds of programs. The programs we have right now are just not sufficient for them.
So I think what those people heard was a reflection of their angst, not necessarily programs designed to address that. Is this as much a messaging kind of lesson that we've learned here?
You know, voting is not a rational activity. Economists have known this for some time. It's costs more in terms of time and effort than the potential outcome of one individual vote. It is largely an emotive kind of thing. We get our inspiration to vote and to go to the polls on the basis of the passion we feel about an issue or a person. Trump had the personality to pull out that passion among a certain segment of people, and they showed up this time to vote when they did not before.
Does any of this look familiar? In other words, can we look back in the history and say, oh yeah, this has happened before, and you're going to see more candidates like this?
Yeah, I think you're going to see that this is a winning formula for some candidates. Right now, it's difficult to know for whom, though, because the Republican Party has to completely retool. They either have to toss out some of the programs and the policy prescriptions that they've had for years that are more moderate and adopt Donald Trump's positions, or the Democrats may move in and try to recapture the disaffected working class that they used to have but then lost.
Some of the confusion for some of us has to be the makeup of America has changed so much. What happened to that?
It is changing, and it will continue to change. And the number of Hispanics, the number of Asians is increasing rapidly. Every 4 years, the number of white members of the electorate decreases by about 2 percentage points. And the number of those in minority groups increases. And so we're moving toward a different kind of electorate. The tipping point did not happen this year.
Because of the candidate who was offered.
Exactly right. Because of the candidate and because the candidate motivated some of those uninspired white voters. But the change is inevitable and it is coming.
It's sometimes difficult to talk about, but there was a racial component to this election as well.
Yes, there was. If you look at the white vote, the only category of white voters who voted for Clinton over Trump were college-educated women. Every other subgroup of white voters voted for Trump, and they voted for Trump in larger numbers than they voted for Mitt Romney 4 years ago. And it's hard to escape the conclusion that there's some there's some kind of racial component involved, perhaps a reaction to the last 8 years of the Obama administration.
Could be sexism as well.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, this is the first time we've had a woman running for president from a major party, and it's hard to gauge that historically.
Let's talk about the Indiana races. How do you analyze what happened, say, in the governor's race, where you had a Democratic candidate who came very, very close 4 years ago, but lost by an even greater margin this year? Coattails?
Absolutely. There was a 19% advantage for Trump at the top of the ticket, and he brought the entire Republican Party with him into office. 4 years ago, you had the most votes gathered by any candidate statewide was Glenda Ritz. She lost as well this time. And so clearly, name recognition wasn't as important. Evan Bayh, obviously, is a name that's highly recognizable. And the massive size of the Trump victory pulled to victory all of the down-ballot races.
Any other factors in the Bayh loss? Because here is a former two-term governor, a former senator, son of Birch Bayh.
Yeah, certainly. There was a lot of money spent against him. There's been about $39 million thrown into this race, a lot of it by interests that wanted to keep the Senate Republican. And the ads were constant. He was pilloried in the press and on TV because he left Indiana and because of his ties to lobbyists.
What can we make out of the success that Bernie Sanders had? Is there any way to know whether he might have been more successful?
It's hard to know whether he'd be more successful than Clinton, but certainly he tapped into the same kind of populism and populist fervor that Donald Trump did on the right. There's a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern on the left, just as there is on the right. Bernie was a very good vehicle for that concern. Hillary was not. Hillary was a more moderate, middle-of-the-road candidate. She came over to Bernie's positions late, and Bernie did throw his support to her, but she certainly didn't have the kind of energy, and she wasn't associated with those issues as vibrantly as Bernie Sanders was.
Thinking back to 2008, I'm just recalling from memory, that was the largest turnout ever for younger voters, right? They didn't come through this year.
No, they didn't. You know, Barack Obama has a charisma. He's a motivator. His message of hope 8 years ago really resonated with young people. 4 years ago, fewer young people showed up. They still supported him when they did show up. This year, the numbers dwindled again. And of course, there were third-party candidates they could be attracted to. And so millennials who believed that life was going to change permanently for the better 8 years ago found out that politics isn't quite that way.
Professor Joe Losco, Chair of the Department of Political Science at Ball State and co-director of the Bowen Center for Public Affairs. Glad we got to talk with him and with Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center at IU-Purdue Fort Wayne. If you'd like to hear more, the Ball State Political Science Department is hosting a post-election roundtable on Thursday, November 17th at 3 p.m. in the Burkhart Building. More information on the university calendar or give me a call. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and all the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, and Debbie Webb. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.